Hello and welcome to our quarterly podcast discussing activities to support consistent application. And this podcast covers the quarter to September 2021. I'm Petrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB's technical staff, and I'm here today with Sue Lloyd, Vice Chair of the Board and Chair of the Interpretations Committee. In today's podcast, we're going to cover the discussions at the September Interpretations Committee meeting, when the committee discussed feedback on two tentative agenda decisions and voted to finalise those, decided to publish two tentative agenda decisions, and also provided input on the board's project on lease liabilities in a sale and leaseback. Now, the board will consider the committee's input on that project at a future board meeting, so more on sale and leaseback in a future podcast. So today we're going to focus on the agenda decisions and tentative agenda decisions. And I'm going to start with the two agenda decisions proposed for finalisation. Now, I note that both of these are proposed for finalisation. The board will actually discuss both of these topics at its October meeting, and assuming that no more than three board members object to their finalisation, then both agenda decisions will be published in October. So the first tentative agenda decision that the committee discussed the feedback on relates to non-refundable value-added tax, or VAT, on lease payments. So this is where an entity, typically because of the nature of its operations, can recover only a portion of the VAT it pays on purchasing goods and services, including amounts it pays for leases. And the submitter asked whether the lessee includes any non-refundable VAT as part of the lease payments for a lease, or does it otherwise consider the non-refundable VAT to be a separate tax expense? Now, in the tentative agenda decision, the committee had reported that it had obtained limited evidence that non-refundable VAT and lease payments is material for affected lessees, and limited evidence of diversity in the way lessees in similar circumstances account for that non-refundable VAT. And most respondents to the tentative agenda decision agreed with the committee's decision not to add a standard setting project on the topic. But some suggested that the agenda decision should include explanatory material, material that would explain the accounting that a lessee would apply in accounting for non-refundable VAT on lease payments. Now, although some respondents suggested adding that material, respondents didn't, however, provide any additional evidence that non-refundable VAT on lease payments is material to affected lessees, nor did they provide any additional evidence of diversity in the way lessees account for non-refundable VAT. And in fact, we had received information to say that the non-refundable portion of VAT is immaterial for many entities affected, which are often financial institutions. So having considered that feedback, the committee decided to propose the agenda decision for finalisation without adding explanatory material. And in that agenda decision, it's explaining that it received limited evidence that the matter is widespread effect.
If it's okay, Petrina, I might add a couple of points on this one, if it's okay. Not so much on the sort of technical question, but more on the process. So I think that this discussion was important to really explain the process that's applied to decide on how the committee approaches the questions that get submitted, and really to emphasise just how important evidence gathering is in this process. So whenever the committee decides not to undertake standard setting, it publishes an agenda decision that explains that. But often agenda decisions also include explanatory material to explain the accounting for the questions submitted applying the IFRS standards. And this agenda decision proposed for finalisation doesn't include that sort of explanatory material. So it doesn't explain how a lessee accounts for non-refundable VAT on lease payments. And that's because the topic didn't meet the first criteria that's required for standard setting, which is that the matter must have widespread effect and have or be expected to have a material effect on the entities that are affected. Now, some people might say, well, I thought you guys were trying to be helpful whenever you could be, so why didn't the committee just tell stakeholders how to account for the non-refundable VAT anyway? Wouldn't that be helpful? Well, maybe it would be, but then again, maybe it wouldn't be. So we're really careful. The committee's work causes change for some entities, and when the matter's widespread, that change makes sense. It's worthwhile because ultimately the result is greater consistency in application of IFRS standards. But if the matter isn't widespread or it's not material for entities that are affected, then the benefit from any change that might be caused by the committee's work is much reduced. And that's why the Due Process Handbook sets out this criteria that the committee has to apply to analyse whether to add a standard setting project on the question that's come in. So really what's important for me is that the committee reached its decision in this case without analysing the accounting for non-refundable VAT by applying the requirements in the Due Process Handbook as it's required to do so. And the committee has received limited evidence that this is an application question that gives rise to the potential for material differences being reported on, even by affected entities, so even by entities who do have non-refundable VAT on their leases. And on that basis, it said no to standard setting. So really, I just wanted to emphasise the importance of evidence. It's really an essential part of both the board's work and the committee's work. So I'd really encourage stakeholders, to the extent that is possible, if you're commenting on tentative agenda decisions, please be specific in your responses and really provide us with the evidence that we need, that the financial reporting question really matters and it's material when that is the case.
Great, thank you. So I think really helpful points there on the committee's process. So let's move on to the second agenda decision then proposed for finalisation, which is on warrants. So just as a reminder, the question related to the application of IAS 32 to particular warrants issued by an entity. So the warrants in question provide the holder with the right to buy a fixed number of the issuer's equity instruments for an exercise price that will only be fixed at a future date. So on initial recognition, the issuer classifies the warrants as financial liabilities because of the variability in the exercise price. So in short, the fixed for fixed condition wasn't met. And the submitter then asked whether the issuer classified the warrants as equity instruments once the warrants exercise price is fixed. Now, in the tentative agenda decision, the committee had suggested that the board consider the question asked as part of its broader discussions on the FICE project, and really for a couple of reasons. The first is because similar questions about the classification of warrants arise in other circumstances, so it really wouldn't make sense to consider this specific question asked in isolation. And the second reason is because reclassification by the issuer has actually already been identified as one of the practice issues the board will consider in the FICE project. Now, respondents to the tentative agenda decision largely agreed with the committee's views on the submission, so the committee voted to finalise the agenda decision, again without explanatory material. So that agenda decision will be published in October, assuming that the board doesn't object to it. So those are the agenda decisions proposed for finalisation. If we move on to the tentative agenda decisions, and these address two new questions that were discussed by the committee and that are now actually currently out for comment. And both of these new questions were about cash. So the first is a question about cash held in a demand deposit that is actually sort of where the amounts held in that deposit are sort of earmarked for a specified purpose. So the facts are that the entity has a demand deposit account and the entity can access the amounts held in that account whenever it wants to. However, the entity also has a contractual obligation with a third party to keep a specified amount of cash in that demand deposit and to use that cash only for a specified purpose. And in fact, the entity would be in breach of its contract with the third party if it were to use the cash for anything other than the specified purpose. So the question asked whether the entity presents the demand deposit as cash and cash equivalents in its cash flow statement and balance sheet, or whether the contractual restrictions on use of the cash means that the amounts held are no longer cash for IFRS purposes. So Sue, is this cash for the purposes of presentation?
Well, the committee concluded that yes, it is, and let me explain what the basis for that was. So IAS 7 defines cash as comprising cash on hand and demand deposits. And there's nothing further in IAS 7 about that definition. So the definition very much focuses on the nature of the items. If the nature is that of cash on hand or is a demand deposit, then the item is cash. And in the facts discussed by the committee, the demand deposit is just that, a demand deposit. The entity can access the amounts held on the deposit on demand. So the terms of the contract with the third party have no effect on the entity's ability to access the amounts held on deposit. So the committee concluded that they have no effect on the nature of the amounts in the deposit account. So they should be presented as cash in the entity's cash flow statement and balance sheet. So in a nutshell, the committee concluded that contractual restrictions on the use of a demand deposit do not result in the deposit no longer being cash for these purposes, unless those restrictions actually change the nature of the deposit in a way that it would no longer meet the definition of cash.
So although the committee agreed with this analysis, by the way, the committee clearly, as you say, concluded that even though there were restrictions on use here, this demand deposit would still be presented as cash. I think there was quite a bit of discussion at the meeting just about how important these contractual restrictions could be. You know, it makes the sort of this cash very different from a situation where there are no restrictions. And I suppose that those restrictions, therefore, could be something that could be really critical for an investor to understand in some cases. So maybe you could comment on that.
Yes, I think that was a really important discussion. So in the fact pattern that we're looking at, there were restrictions on cash balances held. And it's something that the committee discussed at length at its September meeting, and it's actually addressed in the tentative agenda decision. So if you look at that tentative agenda decision, it refers to a couple of relevant disclosure requirements in the IFRS standards. The first are paragraphs 45 and 48 of IAS 7, which require disclosure of the components of cash and cash equivalents, and also the amount of significant cash and cash equivalent balances held by an entity that aren't available for use by the group. The tentative agenda decision also comments on IFRS 7 and the liquidity risk disclosure requirements in that standard. So the restrictions on the use of these cash balances and this fact pattern could affect an entity's liquidity risk. So an entity would also need to have a look at those requirements and see whether disclosure is necessary. And finally, the tentative agenda decision points out the general disclosure requirements in IAS 1. And in particular, paragraph 31 of IAS 1, which require the entities to consider whether anything additional needs to be disclosed over and above that specifically required by an IFRS standard to enable investors, in this case, to understand the impact of restrictions on cash on the entity's financial position. So I think, in short, if this restriction was a big deal, related to a big amount of cash and material consideration from the perspective of investors in that company, I think a company really would need to think hard about what extra information might be needed just to make it clear that this isn't just like cash and that needs to be carefully considered.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Sue. So I'm going to move on to then the second new question the committee discussed, which is very much, as I say, moving from cash to more cash. Although this time it's really a very different question. So the second tentative agenda decision discusses when to recognise cash received via electronic transfer when the receiving entity is actually receiving the cash as settlement for a trade receivable. And specifically, the question was whether the receiving entity recognises cash on the date that the payer initiates the transfer rather than on the date the cash is received. So the question arises, of course, where the electronic transfer system takes more than one day to settle cash transfers. And it's obviously most important if that cash transfer, in a sense, straddles a reporting date. So where the payer might initiate the transfer before the receiving entity's reporting date, but they only receive that cash into their bank account after its reporting date. So I'm going to hand over to you on this one to really delve into IFRS 9 for the answer.
Better standard to delve into. Okay, so when assessing when to recognise the cash that's received, it's important to look at the transaction as a whole. So this cash is received as settlement for a trade receivable. So the entity first needs to work out when to de-recognize the trade receivable and then when to recognize the cash that it sort of received in its place, if you like. And the requirements that you need to apply to work those things out are set out in IFRS 9. So other than when a financial asset is transferred, IFRS 9 requires an entity to de-recognize a financial asset when, and only when, the entity's rights to the cash flows from that financial asset have expired. So in this fact pattern, the trade receivable would be de-recognized when the entity's right to the cash flows from that trade receivable expire. Now, working out when that is really specific to the facts and circumstances that the relevant to the entity, and in particular the sort of jurisdiction where the transactions occur in. So the entity would need to consider the relevant laws and regulations in the terms of the electronic transfer system. But for example, if the entity's right to receive cash from its customer expires only when the cash is sort of safely received into its bank account, then the entity would only de-recognize the trade receivable when that cash is in its bank account. And then looking at the other side, so the cash received by electronic transfer is recognized as a financial asset applying IFRS 9 when and only when the entity becomes party to the contractual provisions of the instrument. That's paragraph 3.1.1 of IFRS 9. In this case, then, that would be when the cash is deposited in the entity's bank account. So at that point, and not before that point, the entity has a contractual right to obtain cash from the bank for amounts deposited with it, and that would be the point when that cash will be recognised by the receiving entity.
So some had actually suggested that in this case, they thought the entity had an accounting policy choice to de-recognize the trade receivable and recognize cash on either the date the payer initiates the transfer or on the date the entity receives the cash. And I think to support their view, those proponents referred to the requirements in IFRS 9 for regular way purchases or sales. So what did the committee say about that?
So the committee talked about that and noted that those regular way purchase and sale requirements are very specific. And in the committee's view, they're not applicable to this fact pattern. So that means that the entity has to apply the general derecognition and re-recognition requirements in IFRS 9 that I just went through. So IFRS 9 defines a regular way purchase or sale as a very specific thing. It says it's purchases or sales of a financial asset under a contract. And in the fact pattern submitted, the entity isn't doing that. It's not purchasing or selling a financial asset. It's simply receiving cash as settlement for a trade receivable. So the tentative agenda decision points out that the regular way purchase and sale requirements are not applicable in this fact pattern.
Great, thank you. So just our usual advertisement, of course, for your comments, which is to say that both of these tentative agenda decisions, so both the one on demand deposits with restrictions on use and also on cash received by electronic transfer, they are both now out for comment and we'd welcome your comments. And the comment period for both of those will end on the 25th of November. So that actually brings our podcast to a close. It's a really short one this quarter, very unlike the Q2 podcast. But I can already tell you that I think Q4 will be a bit longer and has some interesting topics there. So it'll be worth tuning in Q4. So thank you as ever to you, Sue, for joining. Thank you all for listening to this podcast. We hope you found it useful and please email communications@ifrs.org if you have suggestions for improvement. So take care, thank you and goodbye.